deliberations.
Have a seat.
And our other panelists up for have a seat. In your deliberations, is there anywhere in the world doing it better or doing it well?
I don't know.
Short panel discussion. Morning tea is served outside. 0417-84212 for your questions and comments. Do any of you know of a system that's doing it better anywhere in the world? Eugene?
We hear a lot from the Canadians and the work that they're doing in this space. Both the insurance and the health system is really focusing on well-being at work as a really important initiative. They're often here talking to us about how to do it. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, one of the frustrations is that they come to every state and territory and tell each state and territory several times how to do it, and we're not really listening. So,
Julian, whilst PwC, when you became sick, were obviously incredibly supportive and sympathetic and empathic, they let you become sick.
That's a really good question. I remember having a conversation with one of the partners about were we responsible, and we sort of agreed on 50-50. So I think there's a real message of watching your colleagues and just seeing how it plays out. And I think the other piece, which goes to some of what we're talking about, but I don't think it's really come out enough, is in those early days, how do you have conversations with people before this stuff bubbles? And how do you educate people to understand the symptoms way earlier than, I need 12 months off, please?
But put your hand on your heart and you go back 10 years when you're a full-blown partner at PwC. You're picking kids out of university to become cadets, trainees. Would you have picked somebody if they'd admitted that I suffer from depression and anxiety? Even if you put stigma to one side and you say, this is an unbelievable high-pressure environment, I'm getting measured by what I bill, I survive off my wits and nerves. It's going to be cruel to employ somebody like that. I mean, even putting the stigma aside.
It was a different world then. And from my perspective, I probably would have gone, what are you talking about? I've got no idea. So it would have been that's interesting. I'm not sure we'll deal with that one at the moment. I'm not sure anyone was ready for those conversations 10 years ago.
But you wouldn't have employed them.
They probably wouldn't have got through the first trap, let alone got to an interview.
So, Eugene, you talk about, I mean, Pamela talks about affirmative action, but a lot of work now is high pressure. Kids want to go into startups. They're taught you've got to be there before everybody else gets there. You've got to stay there after everybody else gets there. Hopefully they're not too Gen Y. But you know what I mean? It's not conducive to people who are a bit vulnerable to high-stress environments.
So when I came to Australia in 2001, which is, 16 years ago, one of the first person I employed was deliberately somebody with a low prevalence disorder. And she worked with me, she had bipolar, and she said to me, you're going to get twice as much from me as anyone else. And she wasn't wrong. She's now the Deputy Commissioner of the Mental Health Commission in New South Wales and also works for Flourish. She's got two jobs. She's well known publicly and she's out there talking about this issue. I think this idea that if you've got a mental illness it makes you vulnerable is illogical for me. I don't get that. I think not giving employment to people with a mental illness, that's what makes them vulnerable.
And if I could say, Norman, I think we're kidding ourselves a bit because we sometimes pretend that it's not the case that one in five people in the workforce already has a mental health issue. They're just not telling us about it. Mm. And they may be struggling themselves. So it's there, it's here, it's in the room, and we need to work out ways to support people to get the best out of them in our current workforce. It's not just about employing additional people.
So, Pamela, how do you address the dilemma that Jeff raised, which is about causation?
Well, I think that is one of the fundamental issues because we when people are disclose that they have a mental health issue and they do a personal situation plan, then we are acknowledging that, that it's there and that work can contribute to it. But I think there needs to be a better way through that minefield, because we are prepared to acknowledge that work can be a factor, but it's often not the major factor. It's often that the person has had previously been traumatised or is going through an intense period in their family life. So we just need to find a more nuanced way through that. And so we have those discussions about how we can ensure that work doesn't overly or unintentionally contribute. So there are reasonable adjustments that can be made to any working environment around that.
Julian, can you? I mean, have you reflected on what those nuanced discussions could look like?
Say again.
Those nuanced discussions where you've got somebody who has been employed with an acknowledged mental health issue. The employer wants to do that for all the right reasons, but then you get disentangled, you get entangled up in a workplace situation where causation gets, you know, the problem of causation with an acute problem, and how to have those nuanced conversations.
We, I said to Eugene at dinner last night, it's amazing who you bump into when you start telling your story. And you start talking to organisations about mental health programs and well-being, and they talk about creating this thing on the edge that's going to make everything fine. But a lot of what goes on is either behaviours in the workplaces around the individual, it's around some unsaid norms that people don't quite challenge. So there's actually a lot harder conversations to go on than just the individual. There's some probably soul-searching in the organisations about what impact are we really having, and are we prepared to do the deep dive to ask the question. And you can't just say it's one person, let's deal with it.
So, Eugene, one of the questions coming through on text is, you know, who are the key players in your alliance? You know, one of the things I said right at the beginning is that this is incredibly complicated. It's about the wraparound individuals. So who do you bring into this alliance?
I think you need to start with community. I think you need to be able to connect with, be place-based, look at what's relevant for individual places, what's happening in Wagga won't be the same issue as what's happening in DY, for example. But you need to bring together community-managed organisations because they're closest to the community than anyone else, government and non-government.
So that trips off the tongue, but just be much more tangible about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I mean organisations like Flourish, for example, who are close to people with mental health and employing people with mental illness. Businesses, because if you're working with small businesses, for example, the small business owners, they have high levels of anxiety and depression, but they're less likely to seek help. They're less likely to seek help because if they seek help and they're not working, their business goes down. So what are we doing to support them? So bringing business chambers on board is really important. Universities and clinicians, I think, are also important, but we also need to bring in local government as well as state and national government. And it does tip off your tongue, but there are so many people that we need to engage. It has to be seen as a whole of system approach. The problem is we're duplicating, triplicating our effort because states and territories aren't coming together and working as one. And that's a frustration, I think, for the federal bodies.
Who leads this alliance? Who gets it going?
Well, I think anybody can get it going. We all have a role in trying to raise that up. But I think the National Mental Health Workplace Alliance is probably a good place to start. It's run by the National Mental Health Commission. Lucy Brogdon's doing some great work in that space, and she's already pulled together a whole range of stakeholders. So we should leverage off that.
So two questions coming in, Pamela, around the same issue, which is you talk about workers' compensation claims, potentially, you know, early acceptance of claims making people worse. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, when we were more focused on physical claims, it was entirely the opposite. Early acceptance of claims stops antagonistic behaviour, well, could potentially stop antagonistic claims and allows more management in the place. So are you proposing, for example, that people not make workers' compensation claims, or what?
Mm.
Or redesign of workers' comp?
Yeah, I think we need to redesign workers' comp, because certainly I don't think we'd be saying that people should be not able to make workers' compensation claims. Clearly, that protection needs to be there. But it's about a capacity to work together to see how we can support the person to get well and continue to work, and without putting them into this process that pushes away those supportive strategies. So I don't know the answer. I wish I did. But we know that if we do support people early, that they may not need to make a claim. But I don't think it's right that people would be not able to have that sort of safety net.
Jeff, what does a redesign look like in your mind?
Look, just to put something out there, other than PTSD, work in itself doesn't cause mental harm. Mm. Is compensation, to me, the logic of compensation in that situation is very difficult for me.
Well, how can you say work doesn't cause mental harm, even if it's unintentional? You can have terrible management practices, people being bullied at work.
Yeah. So let's talk about that management practice and the bullying. That's a human resources and industrial relations issue. That's not a compensation issue. So to me, that's the situation...
Isn't that just as bad as a badly designed piece of scaffolding that you knew was defective and somebody falls off and gets a traumatic brain injury? The person who put up that piece of scaffolding is as much the agent of the company as the bullying manager. Okay.
The traumatic brain injury is a very serious outcome. And my tuppence worth on the workers' compensation system is to link it directly with sick leave. So you move straight from sick leave to there, and you ask the person, do you want to go back to that same workplace or not? And my guess is that in workplace situations, for most of them, the answer is no. They don't want to go back to that workplace. Yet our rehabilitation systems are pushing them straight back. Now, you can't put everyone in the same situation. So I would then have the workers' compensation system providing them with 13 weeks of income support, retraining and realignment and job placement support. That's that.
I think they're gone then. I just don't think that can... I think my response would be completely the other way around. Let us work with the person to help them stay at work with some sort of safety net there if they need it. That we know that if people can actually not actually leave the workplace and stay and get well, have the bullying issues addressed, move around if necessary, make reasonable adjustments, address the bullying. Absolutely, we have to have zero tolerance of bullying, and keep the person at work. They will recover more quickly, and they will continue to be able to be productive members of the workforce.
And that's workplace management, and nothing to do with workers' compensation, is it?
Well, unfortunately it is at the moment, because as soon as somebody has a psychological injury, we're required, any sort of injury, we're required to report it. And once we report it, so they're in the system.
Redesign the system.
Yeah. I think this is a classic example of us trying to solve a complex issue with a complicated or simple solution. So physical injury, it's quite straightforward. You recover, you come back to work. Psychological, I mean, I would say, is there such a thing as psychological injury? I think we have mental illness, which is caused by a whole range of issues, including workplace bullying and harassment, which I think is the same as scaffolding. We need to create that right environment, and we need to get rid of the current normal which is in a lot of places to be bullying and harassing. And I think that's a shame that that's currently the case. So I would completely get rid of that idea of psychological injury and look at somewhere like Optus and what they do, and they've shown the impact of this, is if you're unwell, that they will pay for your treatment whether you make a claim or not.
But how can they do that without reporting it?
So they've managed to do that, and they've managed to reduce the cost of treatment and improve return to work.
We can do that too. We know we can do that, yes. But we're not allowed to by the scheme.
You and I will talk about that.
Yeah, you're too compliant. Julie, what's your reflection on this discussion?
It's bloody complicated. I go somewhere else, which is when I was back at work, one of the things I did was go out and talk about being a consultant and what a career could look like. And I went to the universities and I told my story of where I'd started from and worked around the world. And then every time I did it, I gave a little bit more of that last couple of years. I got 95% of the questions on that last couple of years about I'm depressed and, okay, how does that feel? What do you do? Then I bumped into a psychologist who's doing some research with some private schools through Macquarie Uni, looking at levels of stress at school kids. So there's a conversation for me about people with injury and work environments. There's also a wave of stuff coming at us that I don't think we're talking enough about. And actually, how do we get the conversation around mental health in the right environments early enough? Otherwise, we're going to be dealing with it each time it pops into the work environment as people get more and more stressed. That's the bit that scares me.
And you reckon we've got problems? Have a look in a major law firm.
So let's talk a little bit about what's coming down the pike. Yesterday we talked about the gig economy, people with less secure or deliberately less secure wanting to pick and choose what they do, have a cocktail sort of approach to work. Is that increasing resilience, decreasing it? Is it a problem, or is it just a parallel factor of no relevance here? Eugene, what's your view?
So I think it's going to impact the problem unless we do something about that. I think we're going to be looking at being accessible 24/7. Most of us already are. We're at work when we're not at work. We do have the opportunity, though, to start working from home. And one of the problems that is there is that if we're going to work from home, have we got our community networks in place? Mm. And I don't think that we have them in place, which is why we need to engage community.
Fourth time you've said it or so.
Yeah.
I still don't get the feeling about what it looks like when you've actually got it up. So I'm an employer.
Mm.
I run a dairy or I... I've got a medium-sized enterprise, and I've got a lot of employer. Is it up to me to create these community connections, or is it up to my insurer to create these community connections? Just tell me how it happens. There's a lot of opportunity costs and the time taken to work those up, develop them, and maintain them. And I'm struggling to keep my business going, and you're telling me to do all this.
It's not up to one agency or one sector to do it. That's my point. That we've got to come together as a whole system to work this. And individually, what are we all doing around community connection? Are we engaged in Neighbourhood Day in March? Are we talking to our neighbours? Are we inviting them over for barbecues? Whether we like them or not, are we actually building community resilience around our family and our homes? And that looks like people just talking to each other on the street, not just saying hello, but when you're bumping into people on the way to the supermarket or on the way to the shop, have a conversation. Is that happening in your communities? It's not happening in mine.
Yeah, I loved that little conversation yesterday about the gig economy, and unfortunately my brain's always going off into potential answers. So anyone that's got more than two jobs in gig economy shouldn't be part of the employer-based workers' comp system. They should have their own personalised insurance. And if they've got that insurance, they're tipped off as a eligible employee. And that can provide the wraparound services for that person as an individual, rather than trying to think that one of the four employers how much do the other employers pay and da-di-da. So to me, that's a kind of design the system to best suit the circumstances, not try and make the circumstances ram into an existing system.
Eugene, one of the high ROIs you had, which you didn't really talk about, was health promotion in the workplace. And there's certainly a question about that coming through on the text. So just talk to me about what happens in workplace health promotion and how that interdigitates with mental health.
Yeah, I mean, examples that come to my mind, obviously are RUK events, days, acknowledging that people, by asking the question, are you okay?
And so it's not about going out for a run and physical fitness at work?
That can be part of it, but it's not. It's, you know, yoga and fruit bowls aren't the answer to this issue. I think they're not. There's not one thing, but there's a whole range of things. So, for example,
Hold on a second. You say it's not part of the issue, but isn't that a sign that your employer cares about your health and well-being?
No, what I said was not one thing. So it's right. It's all of those things. And depending on your industry, if you're a tradie with two people that you're employed with, it's going to be different to if you're a PwC and you've got a big organisation. The key here, though, is that you adapt your programme to the needs of the people that are in your organisation. So that strategy needs to be built and co-designed by the people in your organisation.
Pamela?
Yeah, I think it's multifaceted, there's no doubt about it, but I think the it's vital that employers offer some sort of basic awareness around mental health in the workplace. So some form of basic awareness training, such as a mental health first aid, or that is part of induction. That's the way that we work it, to ensure that everybody has a reasonable sort of literacy in the space to reach out to other people, and then certainly all the things that a good employer does around health and well-being to encourage people to keep well are all part of it.
Julian, as a former employer, you would have interviewed probably hundreds of people for jobs over time. Knowing what you know now, what would be the different questions you'd ask? No doubt PwC is very formulaic about what it looks for in its graduates and new entrants. How would you change that?
There's a question around, why are you here? Why do you want to join this organisation? And it sort of goes to the bit that we're not talking about, is actually taking an interest in the individual. And the connection around community, what do you do? And what else do you do? Do you play sport? Do you have another interest? Do you have another thing you do in your life, rather than just, I've studied for the last 4 years and I've got these great marks and here I come in, take you. I think there's a sustainability conversation, and actually we want someone who's prepared to come into this environment and take on what it's offering, but have you got the breadth of support networks in your life already? And if you don't, we should think about that conversation.
But of course, in the past, that's not why employers ask that question. That question's been around for a while. Am I getting a well-rounded person? Mm-hmm. And in terms of an employer, is can I send that person into a high-level conversation with other CEOs, and can they talk about art, the theatre and other things, and over dinner engage and be an effective marketer and be a well-rounded person rather than well-connected? So there's a big piece missing from that question.
Well, there's the genuineness in the question. And I think when we look at staff that work for us, it's not about did you meet your targets and did you get the outcomes we were looking for from the business. It's how are you freaking going? And actually taking those two conversations apart, it doesn't happen often enough. It doesn't happen for senior leaders.
So, which comes to the are you okay thing, so how are you freaking going? I mean, in a large employer, means if the answer isn't what you expected, you've actually got to know what comes next.
Well, you've got to build some trust to actually maybe get that conversation going, let alone what the answer might be. So that takes you down a totally different track of what sort of engagement in the workplace looks like, which I think for sustainable employment and sustainable productivity, we've got to go there.
And that's where I think literacy comes in, because often people don't have the script. They don't know. They might be able to ask, are you okay? But they don't have if the person says, no, I'm not, people sort of don't know what the next thing to say is. So giving people some basic literacy and some scripting about how to have the conversation.
So should mental health first aid, Eugene, be kind of not mandatory? You've got enough mandatory things, but part of the story here?
Well, mental health first aid, and there are other courses that do something similar, are demonstrated to be one of the major impacts in workplaces. So for an insurer, why wouldn't you reduce the premiums of those organisations that use and train their staff in mental health first aid?
What's the evidence, if any, around social media at work and its interplay, if any, we could overstate this, with mental health issues, problems, you know, either amplification or suppression?
Look, I can only tell you what I think, what my hypothesis is. I don't know what the actual evidence is. But at the moment, you know, there's significant pressure with the gay community coming up to the results tomorrow. And we know that social media has been quite binary in the debates, and that's had an impact on a significant amount of people at our workplace. So I think it must have an impact.
Jeff, I started off with a challenge today to actuaries themselves and the insurance system not making this worse. So we've had a general conversation about healthy workplaces, better employment practices, better recruitment practices, sustainability at work, a national approach. I'm summarizing now, a national approach, just picking up on this, on alliances, so that particularly small employers have more support around and know what to do, and you're tracking people along their journey. So I think we've had a good preventive early intervention discussion. We could talk for ages on this. But let's just talk a bit more about pricing risk and that whole play here, which one senses actuaries are a bit at sea and frightened about.
Yeah.
When there's more data than you think.
There's more data than you think, that's right. One of my favourite books is called How to Measure Anything, and it plays right into this very question. So personally, Norman, I agree with your assessment of what many parts of the insurance sector and including their own actuaries have failed to do. Commercial dynamics play into that because you don't want to pick up any of the, quote, worse risks than your competitor does. But if I just talk a little bit about travel insurance, which is easy because there's probably no travel insurers here, That pretty high-profile case of Ingram and QBE, I just thought QBE did not have a leg to stand on in terms of the discrimination laws and that product. And so, you know, a lot of people have been forced to take it up and work on it, and it's entirely tractable as a problem, entirely tractable. And so, you know, we've seen many travel insurers just take the risk, use the pre-existing condition framework, which works quite well with every other aspect of their business, and just see what happens. And the answer is, well, not very much, to tell you the truth. And then some of the other insurers are working on, okay, so how can I underwrite and price someone who acknowledges a pre-existing condition? So it's pretty easy to do. Now, for the people in this room who are all in compulsory schemes, there is no question of underwriting or, you know, accepting people. And the only question of pricing is actually at the employer level, not to do with the individual. So a little bit easier in that area, but,
It's a bit easier, but when you see the graphs going up and you don't know how to do your predictive modelling for the future, that's where it gets a bit scary.
Well, I had a great conversation with David Gifford quite a while ago now, and you heard Joe Cagliafori talk about the 80 and the 19 and the 1. And Giffo said, look, we've been working really hard at this, and we reckon we're now pretty good at calling out the 19 fairly early on. And then he said, so what do we do with them? That's the real challenge, because having those sort of people stuck in a compensation system for the next umpteen years is just dumb.
So that's where your call for an adaptive system that's got multiple alliances outside the workplace.
Absolutely. I think you look at people who are currently on the tail, so to speak, who've been on workers' compensation for 30 years in some cases, and you look at the injury that they were first out, there's often a psychosocial issue that stops them coming back to work. And the social barriers to returning work, that we've really got to get together and just break those down. Mm-hmm. Whether it's about If you want to go and volunteer and you're injured and you're on the workers' compensation system, you can't go and volunteer because you're demonstrating capacity. But that could be the next step to your recovery. Mm. So you're stuck at home, you're not able to do anything because somebody might say, look at him, he's ready to work. So that's got to change. We've got to change the way that we treat people in that space.
Establishing expectations and establishing targets, and then for better or for worse, not being too soft and cuddly if the improvement's not being achieved.
Please thank our panel for such a great session.